Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there's always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'll be hosting this episode. I don't have a lot to remind you about at the moment. Though, fair warning, we are coming up on fundraising season, so if you want to get out ahead of that so you don't feel guilty while I plead for money on every episode for the next 2 months, head over to sunstone.org/donate and drop us a few dollars. Or you could buy some session recordings from the 2023 Summer Symposium. That helps too. You can find those at sunstone.org under the events pull down. Just click on the 2023 Digital Symposium link. So there was a recent New York Times article about why there are so many LDS authors of young adult fiction. And it's true, there are a lot of them, and there are a bunch of writing conferences in Utah that cater specifically to the YA genre. I've even attended a few of them. Some of the bigger names in the Mormon YA pantheon include Stephanie Meyer, Brandon Sanderson, Shannon Hale, Allie Condy, and Orson Scott Card. So why are Mormons so overrepresented in YA fiction? Happily, the reporter asked around about that very question. One of the answers people gave was that fiction was looked upon with suspicion during Utah's early days, you know, as a frivolous luxury that leads people away from milking the cows and from the gospel. So we're lucky to have it at all, darn it. May I read to you something George Q. Cannon wrote? He said that novels, quote, must appeal to the lowest and most brutal passion. They must abound with sensational outrages, deal with the terrible, and be crowded from beginning to end with adultery and arson, murder and mystery, gloom and ghastliness, bastardy and bloodshed. In fact, must be seasoned with every sin denounced in the Decalogue, and a few never before thought of, unquote. Fiction's only possible value back then was to, you know, inspire and instruct the saints. And that attitude has definitely carried over into our day. And thus, we certainly won't put up with graphic violence and sex in our media. So our authors naturally gravitated toward young adult fiction, where sex and violence aren't as common. Along the same line, the Fablehaven author, Brandon Mull, said that it's actually because we come from a culture with large families. So when we think about entertaining people, we think about entertaining families and write accordingly. But Kirsten White had another perspective on that same idea. She says that this attitude feels like a forced innocence. She says, quote, even though you're an adult and you have children, you have to engage with and move through the world in a PG way, as though you're still a child, unquote. So this family-friendly attitude in our authors, at once it makes a lot of sense, but it's also really strange. Now, being family-friendly has definitely served us well demographically. The bigger the families Mormons raise, the bigger the church becomes, right? And the more time that children spend on media that supports these values, the more likely they are to have large families. So it's great for growth. And, of course, having a basically optimistic attitude that Mormonism and Mormon-written YA fiction pushes is likely makes for active, socially invested, goal-oriented people. However, this family-friendliness is strange in the sense that the Book of Mormon is quite a dark and violent book, and we're supposed to read it with our families every day. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people slaughter each other at the end, and they're heaped as dung upon the earth. And there's plenty more violence where that came from, including some pretty graphic killings performed by people that we're supposed to be cheering for. But, on the other hand, the Book of Mormon only obliquely references sex. Pretty much only once, too, right? When Alma is tearing into Corianton for going after a harlot. The funny thing is, the only thing we really hear about Corianton's encounter is that the harlot, quote, did steal away the hearts of many, unquote. Which I guess is a euphemism for something? What was it exactly that she and Corianton did together? Nothing is ever said about that, except that it's really bad. So, this difference between the appearance of sex versus violence in the Book of Mormon makes me wonder, if forced to choose between watching a murder scene and watching a scene of consensual heterosexual sex, which would most Orthodox Mormons choose? I'm pretty sure it'd be the murder scene, because murder is an explicit part of our mythology, while sex is deep, deep, deep in the subtext. This helps make more sense of the Mormon overrepresentation in YA fiction. You know, it's like fantasy and science fiction, where Mormons also have quite a large contingent. It focuses a lot on the struggle between good and evil. There are good guys and bad guys, and the good guys win. And again, this is very Mormon. The early history of Mormonism was certainly difficult. I mean, it was only through grit and determination and a lot of sacrifice that we turned out to be as successful and well-off and accepted in American society as we are today. That sacrifice that led to success is baked into our mythology, which provides a great foundation for writing young adult fiction. But what's really interesting is that Mormons haven't gotten into horror the way we've gotten into YA, fantasy, and sci-fi. Now, admittedly, we do have some horror writers, such as Dan Wells, who wrote the I Am Not a Serial Killer series, and the aforementioned Kirsten White. She also writes horror. But most of our horror writers aren't nationally known, especially in the way our YA authors are. Yeah, I can hear you. You're telling me Stephanie Meyer is a horror writer. But I'd argue that she's better described as a speculative fiction and romance author. We can argue about that later. But considering our relative willingness to countenance violence and our attraction to stories of the struggle between good and evil, why would we not be good horror writers? The first thing that comes to mind is that horror usually isn't family-friendly. But more relevant, I think, is that when we read horror, we read it for pretty much one reason. To be scared, right? We want to go into the darkness. That's the whole point. This definitely goes against the basic Mormon imagination. We're willing to admit that, you know, there must be opposition in all things, but when it comes to darkness, we want to see as little of it as possible, and if some does show up, we want it to be defeated. If we spend too much time getting to know the evil, we feel like we're inviting it into our lives. But as literary critic Daryl Schweitzer wrote, quote, "The true horror story requires a sense of evil. The menaces must be truly menacing, life-destroying, and antithetical to happiness," unquote. And of course, that goes against our focus on the great plan of happiness. Mormons focus on the light at the end of the tunnel, not the creepy crawlies inside of it, which is good for our success as a culture. I mean, our basic optimism has served us well. The last reason that it's so interesting that Mormons don't produce many horror writers is that we actually believe in the supernatural world. I mean, Doctrine and Covenants 129 tells you how to identify an evil spirit. And we have stories from early missionaries about them physically battling evil spirits. And we're reminded quite frequently from the pulpit that there really is a devil. But the thing is, when we talk about encountering these beings, it's not their scariness that interests us. It's the battle with them. Because, admit it, Mormon theology has basically neutered demons. They're just the spirits from the great council in heaven that followed Satan and were cast down. You know, they were persuaded by the wrong orator and now they want us to be miserable like they are. So they look like us. No horns or wings or hooves or really long tongues. They're just human-shaped meanies. Now, horror, on the other hand, is really interested in digging into what strange places evil beings come from, and how they manifest themselves, how icky they are, and what they're trying to accomplish. Remember, that George Q. Cannon condemned novels because they are, quote, seasoned with every sin denounced in the Decalogue and a few never before thought of, unquote. And that's pretty much the focus of the horror genre. That's not what Mormons do. We don't think about evil's details. We think about the struggle for righteousness. So that's why I say it both makes sense and doesn't make sense that we have so few nationally known horror writers. We have all the resources to write horror, but we don't have the right mindset. We're interested in the heroic ending, whereas horror is interested in the scary middle. However, I want to offer one more idea about why we don't tend to write horror. And that is because there is such a deep horror at the core of Mormon theology that I think is just too real for us to approach with any kind of objectivity. And, oddly enough, that horror has been best expressed in the movie Saw. First, spoiler alert. Saw opens with two men, a photographer and a doctor, played, by the way, by Cary Elwes, who plays Wesley in The Princess Bride. So they wake up chained to pipes in an abandoned industrial bathroom, and each one finds a microcassette tape in their pocket, and they listen to a distorted voice telling the doctor that he has to kill the photographer in order to escape the bathroom and save his family from being murdered. As it turns out, the two men have fallen into the clutches of a serial killer named Jigsaw, whose ostensible motivation is to teach people the value of their lives by making them work hard to save them. So, for example, one guy who'd tried to commit suicide by cutting his wrists is made to fight his way through a room filled with razor wire before a door attached to his timer slams shut. And then similarly, a junkie must cut open the stomach of a drugged man to retrieve a key that will free her from a modified bear trap installed on her head, which is also on a timer. Interestingly, after recounting her horrific experience, she admits that the ordeal helped her get her life on track. What does this bizarre setup have to do with Mormonism? Well, obviously, it's a metaphor for the plan of salvation. As a quick refresher for those of you who didn't teach this concept every day of your lives for 2 years straight, according to Mormon theology, the spirits of humans lived in the pre-mortal life with God until God created a planet for the spirits to live on in mortal bodies. However, these humans would have no memory of the premortal life and would have only their own experience to steer by. The purpose of this setup is to, quote along with me, prove them herewith to see if they will do all things whatsoever the Lord their God shall command them. In other words, after a fashion, each of us wakes up in a room not knowing how we got here, all memory of our previous life having been veiled. The only thing we have to go on are tape recordings of heavenly commandments, you know, the scriptures, the words of prophets, spiritual promptings, etc., and our only job is to obey them. So one particularly apt example of this is the commandment given to Nephi to cut off the head of Laban, something which ran contrary to Nephi's normal behavior, just as the junkie in Saw didn't normally disembowel people. But Nephi is in essentially the same situation. The only way he and his family can escape doomed Jerusalem is to kill a drunk man and gain the artifact, all at the behest of a disembodied voice. However, there is a twist. See, in Saw, the rules are clear and the goal is measurable. You know, if you get out of the room or open the safe or escape the trap, you get to live. There's a one-to-one relationship between the goal and the reward, and it would seem that the same should be true in the Mormon worldview. As Doctrine and Covenants 130:20-21 puts it, quote, there is a law irrevocably decreed in heaven before the foundations of this world upon which all blessings are predicated, and when we obtain any blessing from God, it is by obedience to that law upon which it is predicated, unquote. But A single line from the Book of Mormon throws a monkey wrench into that simple correlation. 2 Nephi 25:23. Quote, "We know that it is by grace that we are saved, after all we can do," unquote. So according to the Bible Dictionary, quote, "Grace is an enabling power that allows men and women to lay hold on eternal life and exaltation after they have expended their own best efforts. Grace cannot suffice without total effort on the part of the recipient," unquote. So put into SAW terms, what this means is that the victim is put into an abandoned bathroom with tape recordings of instructions, but instead of saying,
"If you accomplish this task, you will be saved in the kingdom of heaven,"
it says,
"You must do everything in your power to follow these instructions. If you expend total effort, you will be saved, but only after you die, when it will be too late to do anything more."
In other words, you have no measurables available to see how you're doing. In fact, the entire situation is set up to resist measurement, because every moment you live changes your total potential effort. To riff on Isaiah's declaration, which he probably stole from Ozzy Osbourne, "No rest for the righteous." If we're honest, we can never expend total effort. We perhaps nap for 5 minutes longer than we need to before heading out to fulfill our callings. Or, you know, we didn't do all of our ministering 1 month. Or we missed a church meeting when we were only mildly ill and we could have worn a face mask. Or we watched Game of Thrones instead of studying the scriptures. I actually have a friend who was a hospice chaplain. He told me that he had worked with a number of dying Mormons who had held high local leadership positions, like stake president type things, and that they were often plagued with the fear that they hadn't done enough to merit saving grace. It was truly terrifying for them to, you know, be tipping over the edge of mortality, not knowing where they would land in the next life. And I've felt this kind of horror myself, you know, when I was a teenager. I had an almost paralyzing fear of dying in my sleep and waking up in hell. I look back now and I laugh because I was an okay kid. I was just, you know, subject to teenage foibles, not anything more. But I was certain that hell was waiting for me because of those foibles. So one night, I had a dream that I was in the afterlife, getting ready for the final judgment. I could hear a pair of angels walking down the streets looking for me. And I knew that they had these big smiles on their faces, looking for that nice kid who would surely make it into heaven. But I knew my sins would surface in the presence of God and that I would be cast down to the celestial kingdom. So I hid from them, knowing that they would inevitably find me. I've had some scary dreams, but none as frightening as this one. I'm thinking it's pretty likely that I had this dream after reading The Miracle of Forgiveness, which I think is the greatest piece of horror Mormonism has ever produced. As you may remember, or not if you're lucky, it begins with chapters that describe all the sins you can possibly commit. There are the big ones and the small ones. There are sins of omission and commission. But, as Kimball points out, the size of the sin doesn't matter. Any one of them will keep you out of heaven. You have to root all of them out of your soul. I remember the deep horror I felt when I first read that book. You know, it told me that a life I had once thought was okay was actually infested with sins that until now had been invisible to me. And every one of those sins was of the utmost consequence. They were like tiny little alien eggs that, unbeknownst to me, were implanted throughout my body, gestating and waiting to awaken and tear me apart. An eternity of shame, an eternity of knowing that I had failed, an eternity in spiritual darkness. As Spencer Kimball put it, you'd spend eternity knowing that your efforts were eternally too late. This seems to me to be the thing that can truly horrify Mormons. This state of never knowing, of feeling salvation slipping away from us, of finding ourselves full of an invisible spiritual cancer, feeling beyond the grace of God simply because we missed a sin. We didn't do all we could do. And the interesting thing about this horrifying state is that it's one that's inhabited by good believing Mormons. In fact, it's their very goodness and belief that opens their eyes to the abyss that howls on the other side of death. What do you do with that kind of horror crouching at the core of your soul? Well, at the end of Saw, the doctor becomes convinced by the sound of gunshots and screams that he's hearing over his cell phone that his family is being murdered. And being unable to help them sends him into a frenzy. So he uses his shirt to tie a tourniquet around his lower leg, and he cuts off his foot with a hacksaw so that he can escape the chain that has been holding him the entire movie. His act recalls Jesus' admonition. Quote, "Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off, and cast them from thee. It is better for thee to enter into life halt or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire." Unquote. The doctor is the one who escapes from the bathroom, but he's too late, and the serial killer goes after him. In other words, in the Mormon worldview, it seems almost inevitable that, like the photographer character in Saw, we will be left screaming in the darkness as the God figure bellows out, "Game over!" and slams the door on us forever. Interestingly, one Mormon horror author does make use of this particular horror, though he doesn't metaphorically. So, in his novel Last Days, Brian Evanson, who used to teach at BYU but actually left the church in 2000, writes about this cult of men who, like the doctor in Saw, are amputees. The measure of righteousness in this group is the number of amputations you have. So some of them try to game the system by amputating in bite sizes, you know, like just up to the first knuckle of a finger so that they can get three amputations out of one finger. But their leader is a man who is barely even a torso, who can only just lie in a bed, all limbs amputated and cauterized. So he's the one, the only one, who has truly made it, having expended total effort. The only one within the range of saving grace. And it's a good metaphor for how I felt after reading Miracle of Forgiveness, that I had to give up absolutely everything in order to be saved. Now, it is true that the rhetoric in General Conference is much lighter these days. We hear a lot more "God loves you" than "God is judging you" nowadays, and Deseret Book has blessedly discontinued Miracle of Forgiveness. But the core of Mormon doctrine is still the same. After all we can do. What does that mean? Will we forever be held in suspense? Until it's too late? I kind of feel like I should be finding an optimistic spin to all this, and I should have a heroic ending for you, right? But I guess this is, after all, the horror episode, so maybe we should just stew in it for a moment. After all, we don't define horror by its ending. We define it by its middle. Whether everybody makes it out alive is mostly at the whim of the author. We came to be scared, and if that happened, we should be happy. And I'll admit, I have kind of a penchant for horror that ends with evil winning. There's a kind of relief there, a kind of admission, you know, that happy endings really are unusual in life, and maybe it would be good to remember that, so that we can acknowledge and grieve for the stories that ended badly for us. And to prepare ourselves for the sad endings in our future. Maybe the struggle that ends badly is the purest struggle. But anyway, those are my basic ideas about why we have so few nationally known horror writers in Mormonism. We need to make everything PG, since we always imagine that families will be reading our stuff. Our theology doesn't give us a lot of material to work with when it comes to demons. We worry that spending too much time detailing evil will be bad for us. We prefer the heroic ending to the scary middle, and we're just too dang optimistic. So here's the funny thing. I actually published a YA Mormon horror novel about 10 years ago. It's called The Hand of Glory, and it has some really creepy illustrations in it by Galen Dara. You can find it on Amazon, and if you buy it, my publisher will have to send me a 50-cent royalty check at the end of the year. It's actually kind of interesting to think about my little book in context with what we've been talking about here. I realize that I actually broke some of the rules that I've been hypothesizing about here. Except for one. Yeah, there was one that I definitely followed. Now, this doesn't happen very often, but I actually have another episode in the hopper that'll come out in the next week or two, and it's going to be about how the movie Barbie rewrites the faith crisis script. The episode won't be quite as much fun for you if you haven't watched the movie yet. So, that's your homework. Go watch Barbie. I think you'll really like it. And make sure you pay attention so that you can pass the pop quiz afterward. I'll talk to you next episode. Thanks for joining me.